Hello again, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we explore and analyze who's been making news at the Iowa State Capitol, including the governor and state lawmakers, and what the news is that they've been making. I'm Dennis Hart, and as always, Laura Bellin of the political blog site Bleeding Heartland is alongside. Laura, good to be with you again.
Nice to be here, Dennis.
We have a ton of things to talk about, so we'd better jump right in. Governor Reynolds, last week, signed an absolutely sweeping tax cut package into law, one that is going to cut income and property taxes and restructure the state's mental health funding system. It's a massive bill, something Republicans have been going for years in Iowa. They got it. Let's download what this all means.
Well, there are a lot of pieces to it. And by the way, the governor said she wants to pass more tax cuts next year. So we'll see what they come up with. But one of the biggest pieces is shifting the mental health funding system to a state appropriation rather than having it done through property taxes. And some people, advocates in the mental health community, really supported that change. Some people are a little apprehensive about it. So we're going to see that. The concern is, will the state in future years keep up its funding promise to fund mental health? And right now, the local governments, the county level governments, can impose property taxes to make sure there's at least some basic level of funding for mental health services. So that was a big thing the governor wanted, and the governor got that. That was something the House Republicans were very reluctant to go along with. The Senate Republicans were on board early, and that was one of the reasons why the legislative session went into overtime for so long, was because they were haggling over this measure. Now, the income tax cuts, many of these were already approved as part of a 2018 tax bill, but that law had triggers in it so that certain tax cuts wouldn't go into effect unless state revenues hit certain targets. And what they've done in this bill is they took away those targets so that now, regardless of what the state revenue level is, those tax cuts will go into effect. They did phase out the inheritance tax a little more slowly than one of the earlier versions, and the income tax changes are slightly different, but it's going to be a big hit to the state budget in the 2023 fiscal year. It's going to be, I think, about a $300 million hit. And then in years after that, a slightly less. But again, those are ongoing cuts that will happen regardless of what the revenue level is.
So the governor gets to campaign on this next year during the gubernatorial election. How do the Democrats counter?
Well, I mean, the Democrats voted for certain pieces of this, so I don't know that the Democrats, whoever the nominee is, may not be talking very much about the tax issue. I mean, I imagine that they'll be probably saying that the income tax cuts are going to disproportionately benefit people with higher incomes. That tends to be what happens. And the question is going to be, what will happen on the property taxes? We'll see next year, because the governor has said this is going to cut people's property taxes because mental health services will no longer be funded that way. But the state also took away what was called the backfill, which was state funding directed toward local governments to make up for a commercial property tax cut that was passed in 2013. So the question is, will county governments just turn right around and raise their local property taxes next year to compensate for losing that backfill? And that's what we don't know.
The governor also signed into law last week the Back the Blue bill. Now, that is going to strengthen legal protections for police officers, create deeper penalties for protest-related crimes like rioting and unlawful assembly. Democrats did not like this. It was a Republican dream bill, if you will, for them. So let's talk about this one, Back the Blue.
Well, it's funny. I mean, first of all, when you say it would increase protections for police, the police groups didn't get everything they wanted out of this bill. One thing that they got, some small changes to workers' compensation, which is an issue. A lot of police get shoulder injuries. That's been a problem. But one thing that they didn't get that was in an earlier version, but not in the final version, was a sick leave provision. And I think that was deemed to be too expensive for local government. So that was a big concession for the police. One of the main areas that's a protection, that you could call it a protection, is that this bill codifies a federal standard of qualified immunity, which makes it very difficult to sue any law enforcement officer or police department for violations of your constitutional rights. But a couple of the Democrats were saying during the debate over this bill that they thought this qualified immunity language in the bill might be considered unconstitutional. It goes against a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court ruling. And I anticipate that there will be a lawsuit at some point challenging whether this qualified immunity provision can pass muster with the Iowa Constitution. And of course, if it's struck down, then that doesn't leave the police with any additional protection compared to what they have now under this 2018 court ruling. The enhanced penalties for protesters and increased severity of certain crimes related to protests, I mean, that's not really something that the law enforcement groups were asking for. The Republican politicians have definitely portrayed that as something that will protect police, but that also remains to be seen how much that will protect police. And the fiscal note on these bills indicated that those provisions are going to have a very racially disproportionate impact and will, for instance, eluding, which is a crime of not pulling over for a police officer. This bill changes that so that not pulling over for an unmarked vehicle also qualifies as eluding. And in certain circumstances, that could even be charged as a felony. And what we've seen in the past is that a disproportionate number of Iowans charged with eluding are African American. The same is true for some of the riot and unlawful assembly. And the governor was asked about this last week, you know, what about this fact that some of these enhanced penalties are potentially going to affect Black Iowans more. And her response was, don't break the law and it won't be a problem for you.
Right. Following up on that, she wanted a ban on racial profiling this year on the part of police. She did not get it. Why didn't
she get
that?
I mean, that didn't even get a subcommittee hearing in the Iowa House or Senate. So, and that was an example of where the governor chose not to go to the mat to fight for that. I mean, it certainly would have been possible for the governor to say, I'm not going to sign any policing bill unless you include some language on racial profiling. And that was something she didn't do. She was asked about that at a news conference in late April. And she said, well, I don't get everything I want from the legislature. So, but she didn't threaten to veto the bill. So, I mean, that was an interesting thing. I mean, the governor has said that she's going to push for that again next year. But since it didn't advance as part of a larger package this year, there's no way that the Iowa House or Senate committees are going to move on that kind of language next year.
Staying with the governor, she got a Democratic opponent in next year's election last week. Iowa State Representative Ross Smith announced he is going to run for governor. He's a Democrat, the first major Democrat to toss his hat into the ring. Who is Ross Smith?
Ross Smith is in his third term representing part of Waterloo in the Iowa House. He's considered an up-and-coming person in the Democratic caucus. He's the ranking member of the House Education Committee. He's been very outspoken on issues of racial equity, but also on issues of equity in public schools. He's a product of Waterloo Public Schools, and he's stayed in the community. And he's been laying the groundwork for this governor's bid for a while. I should say that when we call him the first major candidate, that's because someone few people have ever heard of named Kim West did technically declare in April that he was running for governor, and he has a website up, but that's not, he's seeking the Democratic nomination, but it's not a candidacy that could really have an impact in the primary. So Ross Smith is someone who could have some significant support in the Democratic primary. One question mark, he represents a safe Iowa House district in Waterloo. He's never had to raise a lot of money for his race. In fact, he hasn't had opponents often. And so this would be to mount a statewide primary campaign. That's something that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so that's going to be interesting to see how well he can put together a campaign. But it was a very well-managed rollout. He had a really well-produced campaign video. He had an event that was well-attended in Waterloo last Tuesday to kick off the campaign. So I think it'll be interesting to watch that one unfold.
If you were to look into your crystal ball, and I know you've got it in front of you right now, because yes, I can see it right there. What other Democrats would you predict could jump into the race against the governor?
Well, the state auditor, Rob Sand, has said he's thinking about it, and many people see him as laying the groundwork for a bid for governor. I think there could be some other legislators who are considering it, but with Ross Smith running, I wouldn't expect any other Iowa House Democrats. There might be, there's a retiring Iowa State Senator from Cedar Rapids, Rob Hoag, who possibly may think about it. Cindy Axne, the member of Congress representing the 3rd District, she has said she's thinking about it. She worked in state government for quite a long time before running for Congress. So I think that there could be other people as well who aren't in any kind of elective office right now. But those are the main candidates I hear Democrats talking about.
We'll be here to talk about it as well. Let's talk again about Democrats. They elected in the House Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights to be their new House Minority Leader. She's going to replace Todd Pritchard. Another question, a simple one. Who's Jennifer Confirst?
She is in her second term. She represents actually my own district and part of the western suburbs of Des Moines. And she ran for the first time in 2016. She was running against the then Iowa House Majority Leader, Chris Hagenow. And it was one of the most expensive Iowa House races, a hard-fought race that she lost. But Chris Hagenow could see the writing on the wall and the changes in the district. And he moved to a more Republican district before the 2018 cycle. And so when Jennifer Confers ran again, the Republicans didn't really spend any significant money against her. So one thing that is interesting about her election as the Iowa House Minority Leader, she's been the second ranking, the minority whip, for the last 6 months or so. She's only in her second term and she's leading the caucus. And the Iowa Senate Minority Leader, Zach Walls, is only in his first term. So they were both elected for the first time in 2018. And I wonder if that's ever happened in history, that both parties' caucuses are led by people with so little seniority. But Jennifer Confers, she used to work as a journalist. She worked for Iowa Public Television for some time. She's a journalism professor at Drake University. And I think that partly because she represents a district that Republicans aren't likely to contest strongly in 2022, that makes her fairly well positioned to be the caucus leader. Todd Pritchard, who recently stepped down as the Iowa House Minority Leader, he was in a district that's been trending strongly toward Republicans. So that was one that he had to fight hard for re-election. I think they spent more than $500,000 defending his district. And that's not always where a party wants to be, having the party leader in danger of losing their own seat.
Okay, let's talk about another announcement last week. Iowa Democratic State Senator Liz Mathis said she is seriously considering running in the first congressional district next year against incumbent Ashley Hinson. So how would Liz Mathis match up against Hinson?
Well, Democrats have been trying to get Liz Mathis to run for higher office since at least 2014 and maybe earlier than that. She was a broadcaster for many years in Waterloo and Cedar Rapids area. She worked for the Waterloo base station, KWWL. Then she worked for Cedar Rapids, KCRG, which is the most watched newscast in Cedar Rapids. And she ran for the Iowa Senate for the first time in a special election in 2011. And since then, she's been reelected three times and always reelected fairly easily. She represents a district in the Cedar Rapids suburbs that's been trending strongly toward Democrats. And because she was on TV for so many years, and most of the counties in Northeast Iowa do receive Cedar Rapids stations, she's just somebody who starts with a lot of name ID. She's very well spoken. She's very comfortable speaking to audiences. And so just somebody who could right off the bat have a strong challenge. And she also would probably raise a lot of money. And she is just considering it. She said she'll announce her plans at the end of July, but she met last week with Cindy Axne, and I'd be really surprised at this point if she doesn't run for Congress. It really seems like all signs point to Liz Mathis running for Congress, even though we don't know what the new map will look like and whether the new first district may be better for Republicans than the current district is.
So that could be a barn burner of a race.
It really could be. It would be a top targeted race for both parties.
State Democratic Senator Rob Hoeg, we talked about him a couple of minutes ago. He made some news saying he would not seek re-election next year. He served in the 33rd district since 2007. Why is he leaving?
Well, he didn't exactly say why he's leaving. He said he's stepping aside and he wants to let new leadership give another generation a chance at leadership. He was in the Iowa House for two terms and then he was elected four times to the Iowa Senate. So he's been there for quite a while. The Democrats are in the minority and with no prospects of being in the majority anytime soon. And I think a lot of people in the minority, you know, start to rethink what do they want to do with their lives. Rob Hoeg ran for U.S. Senate in 2016. And he lost the Democratic primary to Patty Judge. But it's possible that he's considering running for U.S. Senate next year. It's possible that he's thinking about running for governor next year. He's very active in the environmental community and is a voice for climate change action. And so it's possible that he's planning to focus his efforts on some nonprofit organization working on some of those issues. So I really don't know, but I appreciated that he gave a lot of notice to other candidates and gave people several months to plan. I mean, people don't have to declare until next March filing deadline. So this gives everyone in that Cedar Rapids area. And again, we don't know what the maps will look like, but certainly there will be some district covering part of Cedar Rapids that will be a strong Democratic district. And this gives the local activists a lot of time to think about it. So I expect a highly competitive primary in that race.
Now, you reported that Breonna Oxley and Sammy Sheets are going to run for that soon to be vacated seat. Who are they?
Yes, and I don't expect them to be the only two candidates, but they announced right away Breonna Oxley is the granddaughter of Jean Oxley, who was the first woman elected county supervisor in Linn County, and very close to being the first woman county supervisor in Iowa was just a little bit before Jean Oxley, but she's very well known. And also Breonna Oxley's grandfather was a member of the Iowa legislature for some time as well. Mike Oxley was his name. So she's from a very political family that's been involved in Cedar Rapids politics for many years. Sammy Sheets grew up in the Cedar Rapids area. He worked on Bernie Sanders' campaign. He worked on Fred Hubbell's campaign and for the Iowa Democratic Party. He's just been involved in a lot of different Democratic activities, and he is also Arab American. So if elected, he would be the first Arab American ever to serve in the Iowa legislature.
Let's catch our breath for a minute. Let our audience catch our breath. It's been a hectic 16 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin, and we are here zooming through literally a ton of activities that took place in and around the Iowa State Capitol last week, and we're glad you are along with the ride with us here. We want to talk about a Des Moines Register poll that came out yesterday now, and the editor of the Register, I am going to quote her now, and this is Carol Hunter, a stunning is her word, stunning that nearly two-thirds of likely voters say they would prefer seeing someone new in Chuck Grassley's office. The Register poll showed that nearly two-thirds of likely voters think it's time for someone new to hold the Republican senator's seat. He has served seven terms in the U.S. Senate. He is 87 years old. Were you surprised by this poll?
I wasn't surprised that a lot of people said that they would prefer for Chuck Grassley to retire, but I do disagree. I've seen some people say that this shows that Grassley is vulnerable, that this seat could be highly competitive, and I don't read it that way. And many people have commented today that right now, partisan politics, it's so polarized that people might say, well, I'd rather have someone new than Grassley, but that doesn't mean that they would vote for a Democratic challenger to Chuck Grassley. There have been other examples. There was a Massachusetts poll in 2017 that showed a lot of people said they would prefer someone other than Elizabeth Warren as senator. And yet when she ran for reelection in 2018, she got 60% of the vote with hardly spending any money. And there was a similar thing. One of my guest authors at Bleeding Heartland, Dan Guild, he's been following polls, political polling for decades. And he mentioned today that Frank Lautenberg, if you remember him, he was a long-serving senator from New Jersey. When he was up for reelection at age 84 in 2008, there were also people in New Jersey who thought that he was too old and should retire. And so there was a poll at that time that said, you know, would you prefer someone new or would you vote to reelect Frank Lautenberg? And it was like 19% said reelect and 58% said they'd prefer someone else. And yet when he ran for reelection, he was easily reelected by a margin of 56% to 42%. So, I mean, let's not get ahead of ourselves and assume that if Chuck Grassley runs for reelection, that these people who think that he should retire are not actually going to vote for him. And he's spending a lot of money on social media advertising right now. I don't see, it doesn't look to me like he's looking to retire.
Laura Bellin saying, forget it, Des Moines Register poll. I don't believe you. All right, we're going to see who's right on this one. We're going to follow this. There was another poll yesterday, the Register published. This one about the state's other Republican U.S. Senator, Joni Ernst. 46% of state residents approve of the job she's doing. 42% disapprove. Now, that's better. Those are better ratings that she's had in the past.
Yes. I mean, better than when she was going into a reelection next year. But I think, again, as I mentioned, the polarization that we're seeing today, I just don't know that we're going to see senators with very high approval ratings, which was common for decades. I mean, Chuck Grassley's approval rating was often above 70%. It was usually above 60% for decades. And Tom Harkin was never usually in the same stratosphere with Chuck Grassley, but his approval rating would sometimes hit 60%. It was certainly well into the 50s for most of his Senate career. And I don't think that we're going to see that. I mean, Joni Ernst, again, even though she was reelected by a 6 or 7 point margin last year, I don't think she's ever going to have those very high approval numbers because we just live in a time that incumbents, they just tend to be more polarizing and there's not a rally effect around incumbents like we used to see.
Right. One more poll published on Monday This one showed that most Iowans are confident the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, is going to keep fading away. But Democrats and women are more likely to say they fear we could still see another coronavirus spike. Republicans don't seem to care about that. That just follows the national divide, doesn't it, on this pandemic response? Democrats, Republicans, in completely different worlds.
Yes. And I mean, it's very similar to other studies that have been done of the partisan difference when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines as well. So we see in this poll, it was overall at 66%. So about two thirds of the poll respondents said that they're confident that the pandemic will continue to decline, and only 28% said they were worried about new surges. But then if you look at it, the Democrats, it was more than half of the Democrats in the sample, 54% were worried about a new surge of cases, and only 12% of Republicans and 26% of independents. And with women, it said, I mean, women were more likely to be worried, but it still wasn't a majority of women. It was 36% of women in the sample, and only 20% of men in the sample said they were worried about new surges. And it's interesting. I mean, there are in Southwest Missouri right now, there's a surge in hospitalizations happening because of this Delta variant of COVID-19. But I just don't think that that's gotten through. I mean, the United Kingdom right now is dealing with a surge in cases and hospitalizations. And so it's a race against the variants to see if we can get enough people vaccinated to not let these variants get a foothold.
Well, there's other news, and part of it came out Monday afternoon. Word that students at Iowa's public universities will see higher tuition and fee rates for the upcoming school year under a new proposal that's going to be taken up for the first time by the State Board of Regents later this week. So let's talk about those potential increases, but even more importantly, why those increases are coming about.
Well, when the Republicans were debating the education budget this year, one of the big sticking points was, would the Regents universities get any funding increase compared to last year? And also, would the Regents be prevented from imposing tuition increases? And the House Republicans had a budget that was a flat budget, no increase at all for the Regents universities, and a line that said that the Regents couldn't raise tuition. And that would have been unprecedented. I don't think the legislature has ever meddled that way with the Regents' ability to set tuition rates at the university. So from the university's perspective, that would have been a bit of a financial catastrophe. So they did get a small funding increase this year, and the tuition increase that they're planning will probably bring in a little bit more funding. Of course, the universities also have some federal funding coming from the American Rescue Plan, the COVID-19 relief bill, but they've lost money in other ways. They lost money from sports and some other things. And so I think the tuition increases, they're going to be more at Iowa State University and at the University of Iowa than at UNI, at least under the proposal that was announced today. But it is definitely going to be a hardship for some students.
Right. And to specify, it'd be about $280 increases for in-state residents at Iowa State and Iowa State University, University of Iowa and Iowa State University, and about $100, a little bit more than $100 at UNI. We'll be following that one. You were talking about Rob Sand a few minutes ago, a potential Democratic candidate against Governor Kim Reynolds next year. And now comes word that the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board is looking into whether the governor violated any laws by appearing in some public service announcements for mask wearing last year. We talked about this last week, but now the new information is the investigation. Let's talk about that.
Well, the public service announcements were no problem. The issue is that they were taxpayer funded. So the Iowa Department of Public Health used part of their funding through the CARES Act, that was a federal COVID-19 relief plan, to fund an advertising campaign. It was about $500,000 on radio, TV, online, newspaper ads, starting in mid-November, that was called Step Up, Stop the Spread. So Governor Reynolds appeared in some of the radio and TV ads. And since 2018, Iowa's had a law that said state officials and state legislators cannot use taxpayer funds to promote themselves. And it's very specific about, you know, your name, your likeness, and your voice can't be in certain kinds of advertising. So the state auditor's office issued a report early this month that said that the governor violated this law. It's a little bit unclear because the first sentence of the law does seem to have an exemption for a disaster emergency situation like this pandemic, which the governor has declared a disaster emergency, but it's not very clearly worded. So the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board has jurisdiction over enforcing all provisions of this kind of ethics law and this chapter of the code, but they've never considered this emergency exemption before. So the executive director told me on Friday that the board is going to consider these ads. Rob Sand had asked the board to consider that, and the executive director confirmed that he did not give the governor's office any kind of prior approval to run the ads. He didn't screen the ads prior to their release. And this is just something the board will probably take up at their meeting in August.
And we'll be following that. Let's talk about the state Supreme Court. It made a number of key rulings last week, one of them involving a lawsuit challenging the state's protection of the Raccoon River. Let's download that one.
This was a big disappointment for the Iowa environmental community. Food and Water Watch and Iowa Citizens for Community Action had filed this lawsuit saying that the state of Iowa wasn't protecting the public's interest in water quality in the Raccoon River. And so this is a kind of a complicated area of the law, this public trust doctrine. And what the Supreme Court ended up doing was in effect punting and saying, well, this is the plaintiffs don't have standing to bring this, and the effort to use the public trust doctrine in this way is a political question that the court shouldn't be considering. But it was a 4-3 ruling, and two of the conservative justices appointed by Governor Reynolds actually sided with Brent Apple, who's the most liberal member of the court, and they would have let this lawsuit proceed. This, again, wasn't deciding the merits of the lawsuit. This was just whether the plaintiffs can even bring this kind of action. So basically, the court said that we're not going to get involved in water quality issues in Iowa.
And the court also upheld a provision of Waterloo's Ban the Box ordinance. I'm going to let you explain that.
Yeah, so Ban the Box ordinances are designed to address racial disparities in hiring. Because people of color are more likely to have a criminal record, when a job application asks somebody to list, have you ever been arrested or charged with a crime or convicted with a crime, that's something that can get people filtered out before they ever get a chance to have an interview or present themselves to employers. So what Waterloo has done, it's similar to ordinances that are in effect in some other parts of the country, said employers cannot ask about somebody's criminal history during the application process. They can only ask about that after they've made a conditional offer of employment, or if the job applicant volunteers that information at the interview. The other parts of the ordinance said that employers with at least 15 employees can't make hiring decisions based on someone's criminal history. And that part of the ordinance, the Supreme Court struck down. They said that that conflicted with a state law passed in 2017 that said that the local governments can't regulate this certain kinds of terms or conditions of employment. But they said that regulating whether someone can ask about criminal history on the application was not a term or condition of employment. That was just regulating the timing of those questions. So they let that part stand. So for now, the employers in Waterloo are going to have to comply with that and not ask people on their application about the criminal history. Now, I do expect the Republican-controlled legislature to come in and fix that part of the code next year to overrule that ordinance. But for now, it stands.
So we have a little bit more than a minute left. Plenty of time, Laura, to talk about the state Supreme Court also banning police from searching people's uncollected trash without a warrant. I think this is an interesting story that didn't get a lot of play.
This was a big deal. Ryan Foley of the Associated Press had a good report on this. This was at a majority opinion and then three different dissenting opinions, and the whole thing ran about 125 pages. So it was very complicated, but four justices, including three conservatives, and one of the most conservatives, Christopher McDonald, was the one who wrote the majority of opinion, saying this is a police tactic that's been used for decades. And they said, no, you're going to have to get a warrant if you're searching trash that people leave out on the curb. And the three dissenting justices, who were also conservatives, two Brandsett appointees and one Reynolds appointee, they were really vehement. I mean, they used some sharp words in their dissenting opinions on this ruling, and they felt that this was going to put police in a difficult situation, and they also didn't feel that it was consistent with some of the court's other rulings. So we'll see where this goes and whether this leads to other lawsuits by people who were convicted based on what was found in their trash. I mean, it's very common in drug crime investigations for police to go through people's trash.
Laura, we've gone through a lot of our trash tonight, and we have gotten a lot of information out. You did a heck of a job. Thank you very much. We are just about out of time. We should remind you that the opinions expressed here were not necessarily those of KHOI staff or its management. They are ours. You've been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. Laura Bell and I will be right back here, we hope, in this time slot next week with a look at what makes news with the governor and with Iowa lawmakers and what it means for all of us. Until then, have a great week.